One commentator points out that in genre, it stands very close to the epic stories of Abraham, of Moses, and so on, that it has many similarities with the Book of Ruth, and that many things about it are comparable to other passages of Scripture which we do take as literal. In Ezekiel chapter 14, Job is referred to alongside Daniel and Noah. What does it do? It relates the basic facts, doesn't it? Essential facts. It relates people's actions without analysing constantly their emotions or their motives. The author is a little bit detached. There's no direct moral commentary. We're supposed to pick it up for ourselves. So in that way, the book is certainly epic. Whatever genre we assign to the book of Job, it has something to tell us about suffering, how to respond to it. Although ultimately, we will come away from it with questions unanswered, questions that we must live with, and responses that we should make. Now let's look at the text in a bit more detail. Let's look at the background. So Job lived in Uz in the east, and here the east would mean east of Israel. So it's not a precise position, but it's probably a location in the northeast of Galilee, would certainly be consistent with later calamities that befell Job in terms of raids by bandits. He is almost certainly not from Israel, so he's not one of the covenant people. He's not Jewish, but he obviously has his own covenant with God. Now, I don't know what you know about the EU, but most of the countries in the EU are full members. Switzerland and Norway aren't. They've got their own covenant, their own relationship with the EU. And this is, I think, what Job has come up with. We're told about him that he feared God, and he shunned evil. And why has he come to this relationship with God? Well, perhaps Romans 1:19-20 gives the answer. Perhaps it's through the wonders of creation. After all, it says there not just that it's possible that people are without excuse if they don't deduce God from creation. Now, fearing God and shunning evil does not imply that he's actually completely sinless. But he is described as blameless and upright. And only Jesus could surely be so described. Apart from that, Job's innocence, I think, is unsurpassed. And so is his grief. The explanation is that he feared God and shunned evil. For fear, we should probably substitute reverence. It's not the sort of fear that we fear of a calamity. He was not infallible, but he was a man of great integrity, and he was concerned about the idea of sin. He was concerned that his children might have sinned, concerned that their relationship with God might somehow have been marred. Some commentators have been, I think, a little bit ungenerous in suggesting that these celebrations on the birthdays of Job's children were some kind of something not far short of an orgy. But there's no evidence for that. He's simply thinking that maybe, I don't know, they had a little bit too much to drink. Maybe they had some wrong thoughts. And so he was concerned for them. But he wasn't concerned just for outward appearances. He was also concerned with what went on in their hearts as well. Could they have cursed God in their hearts? And it's essential that we understand the exemplary character of God if we're to grapple with what happens next. And also relevant to a lesser extent, Job was wealthy. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. He and his family have great wealth. And when you first read that, it seems like an almost idyllic life, doesn't it? They're celebrating together, the family's together, and so on, and they have nothing to worry about. And the prevailing culture of those days, and in some Christian circles today, I have to say, is that material prosperity was a sign of the blessing of God. And if we look at Scripture, some passages such as Psalm 1 seem to support this. But of course, we need to look more widely. So we see Psalm 42, Psalm 73. They will cause us to question this fact. And of course, the implication that bad things only happen to bad people is given the lie, not only by the conclusion of Job, also by Jesus' statements in the New Testament, not least the one that we actually read. Also about the man born blind, so that God's glory could be shown. But Jesus' statement about how hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven, comparing it to a camel going through the eye of a needle, which incidentally is not thought to be a literal needle, but actually a particularly narrow passage into Jerusalem, indicate that wealth and righteousness don't always sit easily together. But in Job's case, wealth does not appear to have spoiled his relationships. They are good. The unmarried daughters are invited by the sons as well. And also there's that arrival of Job's friends later on, who, as we saw at the conclusion of chapter 2, just sit with him on the ground for 7 days and seven nights. Now, I'm pretty sure none of you have done that. You might have spent a couple of nights in hospital with somebody, but you won't have sat on the ground for 7 days and seven nights with anyone. So after the preliminaries in verse 6, then, we see behind the scenes. The scene shifts to God's court. The angels come, Satan comes as well. So there's no indication that Satan was barred from God's presence, but there is an indication by the challenge to him of where he's been that he was an intruder. What does he reply? His reply is evasive. He's been rolling around the earth. Well, of course, if you look forward to the New Testament, you get the idea that he was prowling like a lion. He's looking to make trouble. And of course, God knows what Satan is up to. And yet it's God who initiates this whole thing, in a way, because he says to Satan, "Look at my servant Job." And that whole drama unfolds. And that shows that while God is sovereign over all the earth, he's not so distant that he doesn't govern, not so controlling that he doesn't allow freedom, and not so independent that he doesn't care. He rejoices in a man like Job. But Satan appears to be weighing the scales here, doesn't he? He's weighing the scales of righteousness against prosperity, and he's alleging quid pro quo. You give him this, he gives you that. His response is cynical and clever, and no doubt his accusations are at least partly and sometimes mainly true of certain religious people. You might ask what truth these accusations would have if they were turned upon us. It's also, by its tone, of course, pretty disrespectful, because God does know exactly what is going on. But God accepts this challenge, as it were. He gives Satan permission to attack Job, but not to attack his actual person. And then, in the space of just one day, Job loses all his possessions and all his children. Twice his servants are attacked. Twice there are natural disasters, although we know that Satan is actually behind it all. It just in one couple of cases, he may have used other people as well, as he frequently does. And any one of those events would have been extremely painful. The four together are devastating. Can you imagine something like that happening to you? The fire from the sky must have been incredible to consume 7,000 sheep. The sudden arrival of a whirlwind leaving just one person alive. And Job makes an amazing response, doesn't he? It's astounding. It's unexpected. One could even say it's magnificent. His actions were controlled, they were deliberate, they were dignified. He was in great distress, and he worships God. He accepts that God may take things away. And such acceptance of what he sees as God's will is absolutely unique outside the person of Jesus Christ. In the midst of such suffering, not only does he fail to curse God, as Satan predicted, he actually worships. Would we do that? It would seem, not even occurred to Job to curse his attackers or the freak weather that were the visible cause of everything that happened. The phrase, "the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away," shows how he's understanding these events, because he can't see what's happening behind. He doesn't rail at God or sin by accusing him of wrongdoing. So round one is a clear win for God, as it were. And then we're back to that scene in the court of God as well, and Satan's faced with Job's response to adversity, and he's not willing to give up. Verse 3 of chapter 2 is interesting because although God himself has not directly caused the disasters, he feels that Satan has incited him. I'm not quite sure how we're supposed to take that, but in some sense, God is taking responsibility for it. Satan, of course, won't give up. He challenges God to lift the one restriction he's put, which is on Job's person. And Job agrees to do so only with the God agrees to do so only with the restriction that he mustn't kill Job. And of course, if he did, then the whole thing's over anyway. The game is gone. So Job's afflicted physically. And this particular picture probably does absolutely no justice to exactly what Job was afflicted with. It was very disfiguring. It was painful. We read that his friends almost didn't recognize him. Some commentators suggested it might be elephantitis. And there's a story of the elephant man. Who knows? And his silent, if dejected, response is to sit among the ashes, rubbing his sores with some pottery. The unbearable itching of his skin. And rubbish, of course, has always been a problem for humanity. And in those days, what they did was they piled up the rubbish in big heaps somewhere until it got sufficiently high, and then they burnt it all down to ashes. It wouldn't have been a very pleasant spot, but perhaps Job is being treated as an outcast. Perhaps he feels he's an outcast. Perhaps the sores revolt people. Who knows? And then, although he maintains his integrity, his wife urges him to curse God and die. It's understandable, if not the right response. She's called foolish rather than evil. And then, finally, the three friends arrive. And at this point, Job, I think, is in many ways seeing things clearly. He's responding in an exemplary fashion. And then, as Tim says, if only they had kept quiet, except that we obviously meant to learn something from what they actually said. And only later do they somewhat lose their way. Now, I'm going to try and draw some lessons from those two chapters, and then I'm just going to go on a little bit after that and just give you an idea of some of the things that happen. So in 4 weeks' time, I'm going to pick up from chapter 38. So basically, there's about 36 chapters for you to read between then. There's 27 days, so if you read 1 1/3 chapters every day, you will get through those 36 chapters and we'll be able to continue. So the main or overarching point about the whole passage that we've read and about the whole book is that Job is never aware of what goes on behind the scenes in the court of God. He knows nothing of those interactions between God and Satan. Even at the end of the book, when his fortunes are restored, he's wealthier than ever. He still never understands why this has happened to him. But I wonder if things are any different for us. Does anyone understand why God allowed the two world wars? No. Why should he allow the continued deprivation of the poor? The devastation of earthquakes and huge storms, the horror of terrorist attacks, the pandemic, the difficult economic circumstances and political circumstances that are aware across the world, not just in our country. But actually, we are in a better position than Job for three reasons. Firstly, we see clearly from these chapters that Satan is on a chain. He is on a leash. He cannot just do exactly what he likes. He needs God's permission. I certainly wish it was a much tighter chain, as I'm sure many of you do, but that's where we are. We have to trust God, acknowledge that we're unable to see the bigger picture that he can. Second, we have Job's example of suffering, which is surely so much greater than anything that we've experienced. And then thirdly, we have the example of Jesus Christ, who was sinless, completely sinless, not just blameless and so on, he was sinless. And he voluntarily accepted what happened. He voluntarily came and was incarnated into a world that wasn't exactly very pleasant. It was an occupied world. And then, of course, later, he was misunderstood. On the cross, he couldn't find God. As we'll see, Job had a problem. Where had God gone? So our first response in times of suffering and trial should be just like Job's. We should worship God for who he is. Whatever trials we are facing, we should come to God in prayer, of course. But when we have so much to be thankful for, and I think that must be true of every one of us here, if we actually think through what we have, the times that we live in, we have a lot to be thankful for. And we should worship God and thank him for that. And since we know that Jesus lived among us and died for us, we have that reason to be thankful, regardless of our material wealth or lack of it, regardless even of our own state of health. One commentator interestingly wrote this: "There are no accidents in a universe ruled by the one sovereign Lord. Hence Job's problem. Such mishaps are not a problem for the polytheist, the dualist, the atheist, the naturalist, the fatalist, the materialist, the agnostic. An annoyance, a tragedy even, but not a problem. Suffering caused by human wickedness or by the forces of nature is ultimately a problem only for a believer in the one Creator who is both good and almighty." So this problem can only arise within the Bible and its emphasis on monotheism. Furthermore, it's affirmed in this passage in Job that the struggle between good and evil is not an equal one. Satan cannot win. Satan can do nothing without God's assent. So the second related, so that's the first challenge, worship and thanksgiving. The second challenge is actually simply to do as Job did, to hold on to our faith in the midst of whatever suffering we go through, whether great or little. But also in the way that we view it, the way we communicate to others, if we're challenged on this point. And Job's problem in the rest of the book comes once his comforters arrive, and he grapples with why he is suffering, why God will not engage with him. And for many Christians, it's not just even, or perhaps their own suffering that is the highest problem for them. I personally find the suffering in the animal world as distressing as that in the human world. That we as human beings are directly or indirectly responsible for it makes it even harder for me personally. In light of Genesis 1, we cannot accept any suffering in God's creation as being God's perfect will. But we must accept it as being God's permissive will. God's perfect will did not involve such suffering for Job. But for reasons that we perhaps only dimly understand and comprehend, his permissive will certainly did. He had a purpose in what was going on. And we'll understand that a little bit more at the end of the book, but not perfectly. But as well as understanding that we cannot see into the court of God, as well as holding on to our own faith in the light of incomprehensible suffering of others, what is our response supposed to be? When Jesus lived, he was always concerned for the poor and the sick. In whatever ways we are able to make a response to those in suffering, we should do so. It's an indirect challenge to our own lifestyles, our own use of resources. And at the end of Job chapter 2, Job's friends spend those 7 nights just sitting with him. Sometimes just our presence can be the best act of friendship of all. So this morning, what will our response to suffering be besides worship and holding on to our faith? So those are 3 challenges I think those first 2 chapters bring on to us. Worship regardless of circumstances, holding on to faith despite suffering, and making an appropriate response to others in their suffering and difficulties. We'll move on just a little bit because the story does continue. And in chapter 3, so you can read that afterwards, in chapter 3, first third of chapter 4, Job curses the day that he was born, and he asks why. He longs for the peace of the grave. Yet in all of that, he doesn't curse God. Satan doesn't win his bet. He doesn't understand what has happened, but he doesn't entirely abandon his faith in God, even in a good God. And that's the more remarkable when we remember, as we've already noted, that Job attributes what has happened to him to God. And he says that again in chapter 6 and verse 4. But from chapter 4 onwards, Job's three friends start to speak. And there's a series of exchanges between Job and them. Firstly, there's Eliphaz, who's probably the oldest. He's certainly the gentlest of the three. He begins diplomatically. He acknowledges that Job in the past has been a great support to other people. And yet, if you look at verses 7 and 8 of chapter 4, he is wrapped up in this idea that you always reap what you sow. So he blames what has happened to Job on some sin that Job has committed. And that's the key argument of all three of Job's friends, unfortunately. And surely the eventual, clearly implied refutation of that idea is part of the purpose of God in the Old Testament. His friends only exacerbate the pain that Job is going through. Pain is his misfortunes, yes, but pain that God seems to have changed his attitude towards him, disappeared entirely from his life. And yet Job will not give in. He maintains not his sinlessness, not his innocence of anything, but anything that would justify what has currently happened to him. Even in the face of the possibility of God slaying him, he says in verse 13, verse 15, he's suffering, he's longing for release, and wouldn't we all be in those circumstances? At the same time, he's hanging on to faith. He's still hoping to put his case to God. There's still the glimmer of hope. Chapter 14, verses 14 to 15. If a man dies, will he live again? All the days of my hard service, I will wait for my renewal to come. You will call and I will answer you. Sorry, I'm getting a bit behind on the things. And you will long for the creature your hands have made. And in chapter 16, Job rejects the arguments of his friends, reiterates his desperate situation, maintains his innocence, and in a remarkable moment of faith or insight, he says, there is someone in heaven to stand up for me and take my side. I think in the NIV it might say, my intercessor is my friend. And so Job seems to imagine a heavenly intercessor, most likely God himself, pleading with himself on Job's behalf. And what does that remind you of? It reminds you of Jesus pleading with God on our behalf. So next time, we'll see that Job dimly grasps the idea of life after death, that Job seeks a mediator. A fourth voice joins the fray, possibly the author of Job, and then we'll see that God speaks. Amen.